Not always politically correct, but always correct. Using only primary source stories of those who were actually there, you're listening to Threads of Liberty. A military historian named Gary Boyd said this, "In reality, it changed all of World War II in the Pacific because it proved to the Japanese how vulnerable they were to air attack. It changed their mindset and sense of self-protection. After the attack, they recalled aircraft back to Japan and they became obsessed with increasing the zone of protection for the home empire." Mr. Boyd is referring to the Jimmy Doolittle raid on Tokyo.
The Jimmy Doolittle raid took place in April of 1942. We're talking 4 months after the disaster at Pearl Harbor. During these 4 months, between December of 41 and April of 42, the Japanese had basically been running rampant through the Southeast Asia. They had taken the Philippines, Guam, Wake Island, Malaya, Hong Kong, and Burma. We had not been able to stop them. What the Japanese had hoped to do, it looked like they were going to be able to do, and that is bring America to her knees and force us to sign some type of a truce which would gain massive amounts of land for the Japanese.
So we had not been successful thus far in anything we had tried.
We'd won a few battles here and there, but none of the major battles. So some of the Air Force or the Army Air Corps, which is what it was at the time, some of the brass came up with this idea. We need to strike at the heart of the Japanese Empire.
And how are they planning on doing that?
Well, that's the whole story of Jimmy Doolittle and his men. Because up until now, the Japanese had been able to, with impunity, they felt, strike anywhere. They did not believe that we could get to the island itself. Our planes didn't have that type of ability to fly that far. What they didn't realize is that we were going to do the things the old American way, and that's if it doesn't work, then try it again and make it work. So they came up with a plan, and this was the plan. There were to be 16 planes, 5 men per plane for a total of 80. They were to fly on the USS Hornet, the aircraft carrier, to within 400 miles of Japan. They were to take off from the aircraft carrier, go to about 5 different cities in Japan, the main one being Tokyo, bomb different things like factories, munitions dumps,
warehouses,
then leave Japan, make it to air bases in friendly China, refuel there and make it on to where there were friendly American troops. That was the plan. Murphy's Law came in tenfold here. If it can go wrong, it will go wrong. And if it could go wrong, it did go wrong.
It did not work out that way.
What finally happened was they made it into the Pacific, but they didn't make it within 400 miles. They made it to within about 800 miles of Japan before 2 Japanese ships spotted them and relayed the word back to Japan that the American fleet was on the way. At this point, Jimmy Doolittle gathered his 80 boys together. These were all volunteers. And he gave them the option that he always gave his boys. We can continue on or we can turn around and go back. If we go back, we're safe. We can replan this thing. If we continue on, however, you're most likely going to die.
Because you're flying 400 extra miles.
And you don't have the fuel to do it. Every single time that Jimmy Doolittle gave this decision to his pilots, they said, yes, we're with you. None of them ever turned back. This is the quality of young man that was flying at this time in World War II under Jimmy Doolittle. Emergency took place. Japan was notified. We blew up the Japanese ships that had notified Japan that we were on our way. But then the decision, do we take off or not? Jimmy Doolittle and his boys said, yeah, we're taking off. We're going to Japan. They stripped those planes down to nothing. They took out seats. They took out radios. They replaced the guns. If you've ever seen the movie Pearl Harbor, you've seen a segment that talks about this. They replaced the guns with painted broomsticks.
So it looked like they had...
So if the Japanese came in behind them, they would see broomsticks. But what we did have were offensive machine guns in the front of the plane to fire at our targets. But if the Japanese came in behind us, we had nothing to defend ourselves. We were on our own. Second thing that happened, Jimmy Doolittle was supposed to take off first and fly into Japan where he bombed. The other flyers coming behind would see the fires and they would follow his path because they all had to take off at the same time and not at night. It was in the middle of the day. There was nothing to follow. Also, because they had so little fuel, nobody could wait for anybody else. Normally, when you take off, you have a pattern, you circle, wait for all the planes to get together, then you fly off as a squadron. not enough fuel. Jimmy Doolittle took off first, and he went straight to Japan. The next guy, 3 or 4 minutes later, took off straight to Japan. They did that with all 16 planes, with 3 or 4 minutes in between each one of them. Incredibly dangerous, because if the Japanese Zeros, which was the fighter pilots, come in behind you, you're on your own. You don't have any other planes next to you or around you that can help you defend them off.
Plus, they were flying line of sight, right?
They were flying line of sight. One of the things they did to strip down this plane was they got rid of the Norton bomb sight, which helped them to navigate, but also to bomb. They put in some cheap little tinfoil type thing. But line of sight meant that if the weather was bad, which it was, you were flying line of sight, which meant you could only fly towards what you could see. And if you couldn't see anything, which they couldn't, that made life really tough. As they took off, things got worse even yet. They had a 40-mile-an-hour wind blowing into them. They used that to their benefit. So as they took off, they would fly into the wind, and the wind would push the plane up. At least that was the idea.
So it helped them get off the aircraft carriers?
Kind of. The sailors that were on the ship said that they watched as these young men took off. And one moment, they would see them on the deck of the aircraft carrier. The next moment, they'd be out of sight, because they would have dropped down to many times the tops of the waters, the waves. Many times the wheels of the planes were touching the water tops as they were trying to get altitude, which they did.
Think of all the swearing and sweating that went on during that.
Swearing, sweating, and a lot of praying during that time. But a lot of cheering also from the sailors as they watched these young men take off. They were their heroes. The idea that anybody would attempt to do this under these conditions, because this now, having been spotted 400 miles early, turned from a dangerous mission into a suicide mission. You were probably, odds were, not even going to make it to China. But they loaded them up with these metal gas cans, they stripped everything off, and off they went. Line of sight, they finally spotted the Japanese coast. The honest truth is that there was almost no way that this was going to have any effect on the Japanese war machine itself. When the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, they came in with 350 planes and dropped over 300 tons of bombs on us.
Wow.
On one small
on
port.
Mm-hmm.
We were now taking 16 planes and 16 tons of bombs over the whole nation of Japan.
Kind of a drop in the bucket.
It was a drop in the bucket. You weren't going to blow anything up that was of significance enough to slow down the Japanese war machine. But what it did do, and was supposed to do, was basically stick a dagger in the heart of the Japanese morale. They thought they were safe. Everything they did because they believed they could do it and not have to worry about any attacks from America or anybody.
They thought they were invincible.
And in many ways, they should have been, if not for the American idea and, the, as we've talked about before, the Teddy Roosevelt can-do spirit. But they made it into Japan. They dropped their bombs on a number of places. They did hit some railroad stations. They did hit a Mitsubishi airplane factory. They did some damage. Those that got lost totally ended up firing at railroad cars. Whatever they could shoot, they would shoot. They made it through. Only one of our boys got hit with flak. He didn't go down. The rest of them made it through any defense that the Japanese had put up. What did shock our boys was this, though. They thought the Japanese would be primed and ready for them. But they talk in their diaries and their memoirs about flying 50 feet over the tops of the Japanese fields. And the Japanese farmers would turn and wave to them.
They thought they were Japanese airplanes.
Absolutely. That never crossed their minds. And that's why this was important. We struck a blow into the heart of the morale of the Japanese by saying, yes, we can do to you what you did to us. One place they were told not to hit, and they did not, and that was Emperor Hirohito's palace. He was considered not just to be their emperor, he was a god. Now, you can imagine American boys, most of them in their early 20s, thinking, okay, this is the guy, Hirohito, that started this whole mess.
It's his fault.
I'm going to get him.
Yep.
So at one point, they were below deck on the aircraft carrier Hornet, and they're playing cards to see who wins. And that person gets to bomb Hirohito's palace. At that point, Jimmy Doolittle walks in, sees what they're doing. He said, no way, this is not going to happen. He told them that he had been in London when Buckingham Palace had been bombed by the Nazis. And it literally lit up the English people. They were so angry that Buckingham would be bombed. So he said, we're not going to do the same thing and bomb Hirohito's palace and light the Japanese on fire any more than they already are.
Right.
So sadly, the boys didn't get a chance to bomb Hirohito's palace. They'd have to do that another day. The bombing took place. The boys then headed towards any place they could, the closest land that they could.
Well, but before you go there, I just thought it was kind of interesting to learn, because I didn't know this before, how the Japanese press handled the bombing raid, because they claimed that they had shot down the planes. They claimed all sorts of falsehoods. It was kind of humorous.
The press reports coming out of Japan reminded me of the press reports that are coming out of the Middle East right now. Because what you would have expected, and our officers were looking for this, our politicians were looking, we didn't know how many planes had gone down. Mm-hmm. We had no contact with our boys. We were relying on reports from the Japanese newspapers of pictures of shot down planes, of crew that had been captured. There wasn't a picture of anybody that's been shot down anywhere.
They just made up all sorts of stories trying to recapture their pride.
Their main story was that all of our planes had been shot down in the ocean. That's why they couldn't get pictures of them.
Right.
Well, the truth is none of them were shot down in the ocean.
They just all ran out of gas.
It was a sad story as to what happened. And I know you'll be telling us some of the things that happened. But of our 80 boys, 8 of them were captured by the Japanese. Of those 8 boys, 3 of them were executed, tortured, 1 starved to death, which will tell you how they were treated. The other 4 were kept in a concentration camp for 40 months until the war was over. And here's the fascinating one to me. We were allies with Russia at this time.
Mm-hmm.
5 of our boys said, hey, you know what? We attacked the north part of Japan. It's closer for us to go to Russia. We're allies. They'll help us. So they went to Russia. The Russians met them there when they landed, greeted them, had them drink whatever it is that the Russians drink a lot of. They interrogated them. They tore the plane apart looking at it. And then they put them in a prisoner of war camp. For a year.
I'm sure that is not what they expected.
Well, the Russians told our boys that the American government had agreed to this, and they knew that was a lie.
Right.
The only way our boys got out of that Russian POW camp was they escaped and made a very, very long journey with the help of some underground people that were helping them along the way. There were a couple of our boys that drowned when they bailed out of their planes as they were coming in. The vast majority of them landed in China, most of them in Japanese-occupied China. And what happened to them along the way as they crash landed, some of them parachuted out, was a story in and of itself of bravery and courage. It would be as if, honestly, if you were to get on an airplane today, knowing that that airplane did not have enough fuel to make it to where you're going, and you were going to have to crash land, and when you crash landed, nobody would be around to help you. Would you do that?
No.
These boys did. They did.
No, they did. They did. And I just wanted to talk about 2 particular stories. They were all heroic. One was Doolittle's plane himself. They flew and flew and flew over the ocean trying to look for some little sliver of land. Eventually, they spotted just a little sliver. And one of his crew members says, damned if I don't feel like Columbus, you know, because they finally saw land. He had to climb up to 8,000 feet in order to miss the mountains that were in their way. And they were looking for an airfield that was supposed to be a place of safety at Chuchao. But for some reason, we don't quite know why, they could never get a signal back from the airfield telling them that it was safe to land. And so they didn't know if they dared do that or not. So finally, it got to the point of desperation with no gas that Doolittle told his men they were going to have to jump out and they would just ditch the plane. And so he had them put on their parachutes and abandon the plane. He said to his navigator, when we get as close as we can by the airfield, we'll leave the airplane. The time to jump arrived. Get going, Doolittle ordered. Cole, one of his crewmen, hovered over the hatch, staring down into the dark void. And he said, I was one scared turkey.
Now, this is the middle of the night,
this
correct?
This is the middle of the night. Being in an airplane that was about to run out of fuel and looking at the black hole that would exit you into a foreign land in the dark of night, in the middle of bad weather, was not exactly what one envisioned when enlisting. But Doolittle managed to accomplish the impossible. He had bombed the Japanese capital, and now he was trying to figure out how to keep his men safe. And so they parachuted in, and fortunately they were found by Chinese officials, and they were kept safe.
This is one of the positive stories.
It is one of the positive stories.
And it was
stories.
Fortunate that it was Doolittle, and he was not captured by the Japanese, because if he had, that would have been a propaganda disaster for America.
Absolutely. One of the other planes was called the Ruptured Duck. the names they gave their planes are always kind of interesting. But
come on, they're young American boys. They were creative.
But its pilot was Major Ted Lawson. And he tells the story about when he concluded his bombing, they kept looking for a break in the clouds. And finally, they got to where they saw a beach. And he buzzed it a couple of times to see if it was a possible landing site, because he thought he had 100 gallons of gas left. And his thought was, if I can land on this beach at night, then in the morning we can take off for some place for safety with this 100 gallons.
This was a Chinese beach then?
Well, Japanese occupied Chinese beach. Anyway, so he buzzed it two times, and then he came around for his approach, and all of a sudden both of his engines quit. He had actually run out of gas. And so the plane hit the water, flip-flopped, broke apart. One of his crew members literally went through the nose of the airplane. He woke up 15 feet underwater with his seat still attached to him, realized that he was probably going to drown if he didn't get out of that seat and up to the surface. So he got himself unbuckled, and he slowly made his way to the shore, and he realized, my voice sounds kind of weird.
Yeah, as I recall, he was basically cussing himself out for not having made it to shore.
Right, right.
And as he's cussing himself out, he realizes, I don't sound the same as I'm cussing myself out now as I did before.
Something is wrong here. So he starts feeling around and realizes that his jaw and his teeth have been literally shoved to the back of his mouth.
They've been caved in,
literally. Yeah, they had been caved in. So he takes his thumbs, he puts them behind his front teeth, and he tries to push the jaw and the teeth out. And all that happens is all of his teeth fall out. So then he thinks, okay, let's try this with the bottom jaw and teeth. Same thing happens. So he's standing there holding his teeth and some of his gum that had come with it, finally throws it in the ocean. His crew member grabs his face and says, you are really bashed open. Your whole face is pushed in. But what are you going to do at that point in time? There's not anything he can do.
And to understand how difficult this was and how his face had basically exploded, his teeth had been knocked out, but even his molars. Now, go ahead and run your tongue over your molars. Mm-hmm. What would it take to knock your molars out of your teeth?
Well, plus his bottom lip had been cut, and it was cut all the way down his chin to where his chin was laying wide open.
So he's basically been launched through the windshield.
Something like
of
that.
Of his aircraft.
Yeah. And then he realizes, I'm not walking very well. And he looks down, and he has these huge gashes in his legs, one of them from his upper thigh down to his knee, and it is so deep that he can see muscle and bone, and the skin is just flayed open.
Now, we look at this and go, wow, that was really bad. But understand, this wasn't something that was a surprise. These boys knew that something like this could happen to them. Mm-hmm. When they realized that they were taking off 400 miles early, they knew they weren't going to be landing in landing fields. They knew that they weren't going to be landing in areas that were prepared for them. Would they have gone anyway? Well, of course they would have. They decided to go knowing that these are the types of things that would happen. In fact, I think there was even a story, and this is not to get too into things as to what they went through, but I think there was even a young pilot that was crossing a river, was he not?
Yes, yes. He had been found by Chinese rescuers, the guerrillas, and they were trying to get him to someplace safe, and he had to cross a river in order to go where they were going. Turns out while he was in that river, he got a flesh-eating bug inside his leg. Yuck.
That was probably something he didn't anticipate.
No, I'm sure not. I'm sure not. But anyway, one of the crew member on Lawson's plane was named McClure. He woke up 10 feet underwater and realized this is not good. Which way is up or down? Finally, his feet touched sand so he could figure out which way he had to go to get out of the water. And he headed towards the beach. And by the time he got there, he realized he couldn't get his hand to work. And so he went to reach his one hand over to the other hand to see what was going on. The other hand wouldn't work either. And he realized he had broken both of his shoulders and his arms. But while he was on the beach, the Chinese guerrillas showed up. And after much trying to communicate, first of all, the Chinese guerrillas were thrilled to see them. But after much trying to communicate, the Chinese guerrilla was motioning, now if you'll put your arm around my shoulder, I will get you to this hut that's about 200 yards away where we're going to hide you for a little while. And McClure is busy trying to make him understand, I can't get my arm and my shoulder up over. So this little, I mean, he was small. McClure called him a squirt. He was so small.
He was about 5'4".
Yeah. Said, if you will get on my back, I will take you on my back those 200 yards. And that's exactly what he did. Their bravery was pretty amazing as well, knowing that the Japanese were going to retaliate for their helping the Americans.
These Chinese guerrillas that you referred to were basically the underground. They were the freedom fighters. They're country had been taken over by the Japanese, but they were fighting back in any way they could. It's a lot like the French underground fought back against the Nazis in World War II, doing anything they could possibly do to disrupt. Because you have to remember, the Japanese had been in China at this point for 5 years. We've talked about the fact that Japanese killed approximately 10 million Chinese. Mm. And this was to be exactly the same. These young freedom fighters, guerrillas, carried the American pilots on their backs. They made cots for them and drugged them. They hid them underground. They hid them in caves. They
on hid boats.
On boats. They hid them under floorboards in houses. They were beaten by the Japanese because the Japanese knew darn well that these guys knew where the Americans were.
Oh, yeah, sure. They could pinpoint where the wreckage was, and then they knew somebody had to help them escape.
And there is story after story after story of not only freedom fighters, guerrillas, but the common citizen who was beaten and tortured by the Japanese.
And killed.
But they would not tell where the Americans were because the Chinese remembered what the Japanese had done. And these boys, Doolittle's boys, were heroes. These boys had bombed Tokyo. They were the first ones to strike back. China had not been able to do that. Nobody had been able to do it. But these 80 boys had done it. And they were heroes to these guerrillas, as well as to the Americans at home.
Exactly.
But to the Japanese, well, it devastated them. They were stunned that the Americans had made it this far. They weren't necessarily really upset at the damage that had been done. They weren't happy with it. But the idea to the common citizen that American planes could get to Tokyo was an absolute shocker, because all along, the Japanese brass had reassured the Japanese citizens, don't worry, the Americans can't make it. We're too far away.
Yeah, we're untouchable.
They had no idea what the American mindset really was.
They did not. But there were some final results that happened. First of all, Doolittle thought he was going to get court-martialed. Tell us why.
He was sure he would get court-martialed. Matter of fact, he even told one of his men that that would happen. 10% casualty rate was considered acceptable. And when you've got 16 planes and all 16 planes go down, when you've lost the number of it you've lost, you've got some that are in a Russian prisoner of war camp, he considered that to be a disaster. He told this other pilot that he would be court-martialed and probably spend years in Leavenworth. He did not realize he was a hero,
an
absolute
hero.
The end result was this, and this is why we talk about this. Aside from the heroism and the courage of these young men, the Japanese were so stunned by the idea that somebody could get to them, that they began to pull back some of their troops and their air forces from the outlying islands, islands that would become very famous, Guadalcanal, Iwo Jima, among others. But they pulled some of these troops and planes back to the mainland Japan.
To protect it.
Because they were positive we were going to do this again. We had no plans to do it again. We weren't going to sacrifice our boys like this. This was a one-time strike to demoralize them. But they pulled back some of these forces and weakened somewhat their strength out in those islands. Because of that, when it came time to go after those islands, the battles were horrific enough. If you've heard of Guadalcanal, you know how bad it was. But ever so slightly, we weakened the strength there. But the main thing was a place called Midway. And if you've ever seen, is it Charlton Heston?
It's an oldie, but it's a goodie.
Either one of them, it's a goodie. And there's a new one out about Midway today that's actually pretty good too. But it was called Midway because it was midway between America and Japan. Mm-hmm. The Japanese were 100% positive that A, we would use that as a launching place to attack Japan again, and B, that we would keep our aircraft carriers there, and that's where we'd refuel them and send them towards Japan again. So what did the Japanese do? They attacked Midway. And the whole story of Midway is fascinating, but we don't have time for that now. But what did result from that, because they were so absolutely horrified by the fact that we had struck them as we did, at Midway, we lost one carrier, the Americans. So we did lose a carrier. The Japanese lost four carriers. Mm. We lost 300 men. The Japanese lost 3,000 at Midway. But here's the biggie, and it may not seem like a biggie, but when you think of it, you'll realize it was. At the Battle of Midway, the Japanese lost more than 40% of their aircraft mechanics and technicians. Who was going to repair their planes for the rest of the war? How do you train them enough? From there on, they always had a shortage of technicians and mechanics to fix the planes and even the ships back up. So if something was shot down, many times it stayed down. After Midway, the United States did not lose a major battle in the Pacific for the rest of the war. They were intense and they were brutal as any battle is, but we won them all. And most historians will say it was because of what happened at Midway. And Midway happened because of what
Jimmy
happened
Doolittle.
At Tokyo.
All 5 foot four of him. Bless him and bless those men with that kind of courage who were willing to take on that mission. Our hats off to them. We hope you have enjoyed this story about Jimmy Doolittle and the raid on Tokyo. Thanks for joining us. We hope you'll join us again for our next story of Threads of Liberty.